Right. Our reading this morning comes from Joshua 5, which is on page 219 of the Church Bibles. And we're starting at verse 10, going through to the end of chapter 6. On the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. The day after the Passover, that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites, but that year they ate of the produce of Canaan. Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come." Then Joshua fell down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. Now Jericho was tightly shut up because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Make 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times, with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound the long blast on the trumpets, make all the people give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the people will go up, every man straight in." So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and make 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it." And he ordered the people, "Advance, march around the city, with the armed guard going ahead of the Ark of the Lord." When Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests, carrying the 7 trumpets before the Lord, went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the Ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the Ark. All this time the trumpets were sounding. But Joshua had commanded the people, "Do not give a war cry, do not raise your voices, do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout. Then shout." So he had the Ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the people returned to camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord. The 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets went forward, marching before the Ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets. Then the armed men went ahead of them, and the rear guard followed the Ark of the Lord, while the trumpets kept sounding. So on the 2nd day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did this for 6 days. On the 7th day they got up at daybreak and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except on that day they circled the city 7 times. The 7th time around, when the priests sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the people to shout, "For the Lord has given you this city. The city and all that is in it are devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and the gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." When the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the people gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So every man charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed it with the sword, every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep and donkeys. Joshua said to the 2 men who had spied out the land, "Go into the prostitute's house and bring her out, and all who belong to her, in accordance with your oath to her." So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother, and her brothers and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. They put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute and her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. At that time, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath: "Cursed before the Lord is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest, he will set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land.
Thanks very much, Paul, and thanks to Andy for praying for us. Just one thing, Andy, I need to just point out in your prayer. You said something like, the Lord's thanks for the coffee that keeps us awake in the service. See, that isn't really the purpose of the coffee, right? I'm watching. Right. I wonder if you enjoy reading biographies and autobiographies and things like that. I've got to say, I do. I always love a good biography, and I've always got one in the go, and sometimes it'll maybe be a businessman or a sportsman, and quite often it's a famous Christian from bygone eras, and I love reading how God worked with them. I don't know about you, do you ever do that? Do you ever pick up a great biography and it inspires you when you hear how God worked with people like maybe David Brainerd, who went out to North America and worked amongst the Red Indians, established Christianity amongst Red Indians? I just find it inspiring. I love doing it. And I read it and I sometimes get a little bit jealous. And I think, how come God did such amazing things with David Brainerd and John Wesley and George Whitfield? We could go on and on, all these great men and women of God that have gone before us. And we think, how come God did a mighty work back then, revival breaking out, churches being established, hundreds being saved, the Welsh revival, that type of thing. You read it and you think, why don't we see that in the West? It happens in South America, it happens in Asia and Africa. In the West, we don't see it. And you begin to think, I'd love that to happen, wouldn't you? Would you not love to see God moving in our church in an amazing way? In a way that almost, we could step back and just say, Lord, it's yours. You have to do this because this is way beyond us, what's happening here. Would you love to see that? And if so, what I've got to say this morning will probably be of interest to you. Because what I want to do is draw a few parallels between Joshua and his famous battle of Jericho, which didn't turn out to be much of a battle, did it? It was more a Joshua and his stroll round the city of Jericho. And then it was won. And I want to draw parallels between that and our situation here in Fairfield, in Northwood Hills, in 2011. But first, in case you've missed a couple of weeks, or you've missed even 1 week, let me sketch in a little bit of the background, which will help you catch up. The children of Israel have just entered the promised land after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Is there anyone here 40 years old? Any 40-year-olds? Yeah? A bit more. Yeah, I thought you were. Right. Can you imagine? There's a 40-year-old hand going up there, sheepishly. Sarah, 40 years old. She would never have seen anything but desert in her whole life till this point. That's how long they had been wandering in the desert. And God didn't want them in the wilderness. He wanted them in Canaan. He wanted them in the land of blessing. And instead, due to their own disobedience, they found themselves dumped in the desert for 40 years. Dumped in the desert for 40 weary years. Now, isn't it interesting that Moses, who was arguably the greatest leader in the Old Testament, was not the man to lead them, the children of Israel, into the promised land. He'd sinned by whacking the rock with a stick instead of talking to it as God told him. And God said, Moses, you'll be punished for that. And his punishment was that he wasn't allowed to lead them into the land. Instead, a young man called Joshua was appointed by God to lead the people into the promised land. God was never afraid to use young people in leadership. Never afraid. Think of Saul, David, Josiah. Josiah was, 8 years old when he became king and then did a mighty work. He's one of the great kings. As a young kid, God was with him. Timothy in the New Testament. Could mention a few more. Now, God, he didn't make them leaders because they were young. I'm not saying that. They were obviously, these few I've mentioned, were obviously men of God. But we should never be afraid to say to younger people, lead. Take a position of leadership. God trusts young people, the right young people, to lead. And it's important to notice that even though he was young, he was experienced in the area that mattered most. He knew God. That's what mattered most. He knew God. Very early on in his leadership, God had shown to Joshua his awesome power. And he'd promised him success. Look at these promises from God here. Number one, Joshua 1 verse 9. God himself had assured Joshua that he would always be with him, that he would never forsake him, and that he would help him to prosper and be successful. Joshua, the young man, had that promise from God. If I'm leading, I like that behind me. That's something I would like to know, that God has said, I will prosper you. I will be with you. Be courageous. Number two, Joshua, when he had gone to spy out the land along with the rest of the guys, had been assured that the victory would be theirs as soon as they had the courage to obey God and go and attack Jericho. The victory would be theirs. And God said, my name will go before you. And a couple of weeks back, when Chris was speaking, we heard that happen. Rahab, the harlot, said, why haven't you attacked us by now? The name of your God has gone before you. We're all scared stiff. Because God's name's gone before you. Just as God said would happen. It happened. God had gone before them. Then last week, Tim spoke about crossing the Jordan River. Jordan was in flood. Great barrier to them getting across. God had breached the river. And it says they walked over in dry land. Now, I don't know if you noticed that last week. They didn't sploosh their way over through the mud and the mire and the puddles. God didn't just divide the river, he dried it. He did the same in the Red Sea as well. They walked through in dry land. And as Tim pointed out, the Ark of the Covenant, the symbol of God's presence with them, went with them right into the middle of that river and stayed there until the people had crossed over. God went before and remained with them, just as he'd promised to do. And then once they'd crossed the Jordan, they renewed the covenant with the Lord before celebrating the Passover for the first time in 38 years. God was on the move. His people had every right to be excited. God was moving. Great things were expected. God was going before them. Everything was looking rosy, except for one thing. Despite all of God's promises, and despite everything that God had done in the recent history of this nation, Joshua was still uncertain. Joshua was still uncertain. He is standing before the mighty walls of Jericho, and he's doubting. But before we criticize Joshua too much, let's ask ourselves if we're any different from him. Despite everything that God has done in the past in this town, despite everything that God has done in this church, You know, many of you will be unaware that there used to be a little kind of shed affair at the start of the drive, and that was the church building. Look around you. We have a magnificent church. This was God. God did that. And despite everything that God has done in our lives, and we can probably look back, each of us, and say, I know God was there, I could see God at work there. Despite all of these things, we too have our uncertainties. And Satan plays the oldest trick in his book, and it's this. He says, did God really say? He says, did God really say? And that is Satan's favourite trick. He plants doubt in our mind. He very rarely just whacks us down, but he often will plant doubt in our mind. And you'll get the thoughts come through your mind. Does God really mean me to be here? Does God want me to do this? Is God going to be with me when this happens? Or is he going to abandon me when times get tough? No. Forget that doubt that Satan plants in your mind. We can trust God. And Satan's done this right from the very beginning of the Bible. Think of Adam and Eve. That's what he did with Adam and Eve. He didn't say he can't trust God. He simply said to Eve, did God really say that about the tree and living and dying and so on? Did God really say that? Come on. And her own doubt led her to take of the fruit, and we know what happened then. And so Satan plants doubts in our minds. Things like, are Northwood Hills great days behind them? Are the best days of this church in the past? Are we simply destined to live out a faithful but unspectacular work for the rest of our days? Is that what we're destined to do? Just be faithful and turn up week after week? And is that it? Is that what God's got for us? That's what Satan would like us to believe. There's nothing spectacular going to happen in this church. There's no great work of God lying ahead in this church. He wants us to believe that, and we must resist it. Maybe you long to see revival, but you're uncertain. Could it really happen, or does that just happen in South America and Africa and Asia? You know, for some reason they're okay, but it doesn't happen here. Are you uncertain that God can really do it in this church? Are you uncertain about the price that you may be called to pay if revival broke out? Because let's make no mistake, revival would be costly. Revival might mess up our church. Revival might mess up our community. Many years ago, I belonged to a church in Dumfries in Scotland, just over the border in Scotland. And I met a man in Dumfries who I became very friendly with, became a great friend of mine. His name was Sam Lorinski. And Sam came from a Polish background, but he'd been brought up in Glasgow all his life. He ran with the Glasgow gangs, a time when Glasgow had many famous gangs. And he looked it. His nose was broken, his ears were all bent over and twisted, he had scars on his face. He looked a hard man. He'd been a heroin addict. And he had to leave Glasgow because he thinks he had murdered a couple of people. But he's not sure because he was under the influence of heroin so much. He came to London. He kept shooting the heroin. He reckons he put over £2 million worth of heroin into his veins. And he went to the doctor feeling really, really bad. And the doctor said, Sam, you're dying. You've maybe got 2 weeks to live. And he went back to the hovel that he was living in. He was squatting in the basement of a house, squalid conditions. And his girlfriend at the time said, what did the doctor say? And Sam said, he says, I'm dying. I've got a fortnight to live. And miraculously, his girlfriend at the time was a backslidden Christian who had also found herself in the drug scene, whilst not doing it herself, found herself in the drug scene, living in a hovel with Sam's girlfriend. And she said, Sam, you need to find God. And he said, I don't know what to do about that. I don't know how to find God. She said, well, I don't know either, but maybe you'd find God in Scotland. So, it's a good assumption, isn't it? That's... I think you're closer up there anyway. So he took it literally. And he said, right, I'm off to Scotland. So he started hitchhiking up to Scotland with a fortnight to live. He reached Dumfries just over the border, and he went to see who he thought might could help him. He went to the Catholic Church and said to the little priest, "I need to find God. Can you help me?" And he said, "Not really. No, I don't do that type of thing." Can you believe it? The priest said, "We don't do that type of thing here. You should go to the Baptist Church." So Sam went along to the Baptist Church, and he was introduced to a lady there. This lady introduced him to the Lord. He became a Christian. Absolutely miraculous conversion. His whole life was just filled with miracles and angels appearing visibly to him. And so he said, and the sky lighting up. Spectacular conversion. Handed himself in to the police. They wouldn't arrest him because they thought, why is this idiot coming and asking to be arrested? And finally, when they found out who he was, the guy leapt over the counter and slapped him in handcuffs. And he was put in prison. When he went to court, he said, angels appeared right round the court, visibly. The judge just said, "I'm letting you off. I can see you've changed. I feel that things are different." And he moved back to Dumfries, and he joined our church. Sam joined our church. Fantastic. Except he didn't know how to behave. He kept doing things like shouting out in church and praising God. And you'd have to say, "You're in church." And he would pray, and he was absolutely on fire. He loved the Lord. He would see you. You'd be walking down the street, and Sam was across the road, and he'd shout over, "Billy, are you praising God this morning?" And you'd go, "Yeah." "Yes." And you'd walk on. No, and he'd say, "Where are you reading this morning?" "John's Gospel." "Where?" "John's Gospel." And you'd see folk going, "What?" Looking at you and say, come over. And he'd cross over. He was just like that the whole time, absolutely on fire. He'd come to my house to pray. And we had a 3-story house. Him and I would be praying in the bottom story, and May could hear him in the top story. He just was so excited. And then he discovered tongues in church. And he began to pray in tongues, and the elders had to say to him, I wasn't an elder, but the elders had to say to him, "Sam, you need to just quiet it down a little bit." And he began to bring in drug addicts to church. Don't want that type in church, do you? Drunk people coming to church. He'd bring in a gang of thugs into church. Bang goes the service. You're into maintenance mode. You know, he was doing all this stuff. People were getting saved. But it was tough. And eventually, the elder said, "Sam, you need to stop being so loud in church. Maybe you would be better off in a charismatic church." And he moved. And we lost him. We couldn't handle him. He was just too excited about his faith and about God and Jesus. And we couldn't handle him. And he went off to the charismatic church, who loved it. He died at 50 years old. The heroin eventually killed him. His organs had been so depleted that he died at 50. But what a legacy he left in that town. Everybody in Dumfries knew Sam Rolinski. And they knew what he stood for. And they knew what a difference God had made in his life. But it was messy. It was messy. And make no mistake about it, if revival comes to this church, it will be messy. It will be costly. And if you're not prepared to pay the cost of asking God to move in our church in a mighty way, then don't pray for it. Don't pray for that kind of thing if you're not prepared for God to mess up our services, to bring people in that perhaps are more uncomfortable than what you were used to. Revival would be costly in terms of your time, in terms of your money, in terms of your agendas, in terms of carefully planned services. Revival will be costly. But why was Joshua uncertain? Well, Jericho was big and strong. You can see here the kind of layout of the walls. Massive, thick walls. They built houses in the walls that were that thick. Jericho was impregnable. Or so it was thought. And perhaps you think that's where we are. We've tried so much in this church. You know, missions, door-to-door work. We've got outreaches at Christmas. We've got holiday clubs. We've got Alpha courses. A passion for life. And we've tried it and tried it and tried it. And this town resistant to all of our best efforts. Maybe you even think that it can't be conquered. Even God's given up in this town, in this church. And Jericho was extraordinarily well defended. And Joshua's people, let's face it, were a bunch of ill-trained, nomadic wanderers. They weren't a skilled army. How could they triumph? He hardly dared think it, I expect. But maybe even God wasn't strong enough for this one. So the night before he's due to attack Jericho, Joshua is wandering in a field near Jericho. And I believe he's probably looking up at these great walls and thinking, how are we going to do it? Like any great commander, he's probably looking at the walls and thinking, is that a chink? Is that a weak spot? Can we maybe exploit this? Is there an opportunity? Is that wall a bit lower there? Is it a bit thinner? Whatever. That's what a commander should be doing, I expect. And a man appears before him. And many commentators identify this man as Jesus. It's what they call a Christophany. Jesus appearing outside of his time, if you like. And Joshua, being the good leader, challenges this man. And he says to this man, Jesus, he says, are you for us or for the enemy? And Jesus replies, when I can get him replying, he says, neither. Oh, come back. Can you press that one back? Go back, another one. Yeah. He says, neither. I haven't come to take sides. I've come to take over. That was basically what Jesus said to him. I haven't come to take sides. I've come to take over. Jesus is not on our side. He's not taking orders from us. He is in absolute control. And how often are we guilty of making our plans and our strategies and then saying, oh, by the way, Jesus, that's what we're planning to do. Could you just rubber stamp it? There we go. There's all our plans. And I hope you agree. And off we'll go and do it. I see three lessons that we can learn. Quick lessons from this encounter in the field. Jericho would be conquered, but not by self-will. Verse 14. Before the walls of Jericho could fall, Joshua had to fall. So Joshua fell down on his face. And revival won't come to this church by introducing a big name evangelist like Louise Palau or Billy Graham or Steve Chalk or somebody else local. You will not get revival just by introducing big name evangelists. When you read about the history of revivals, they almost always come after the people, the ordinary people in the pew, have begun to pray. Almost always is it the result of people praying. The great Welsh revival, for instance, happened after children began to pray. A bunch of kids got together and began to pray, and revival broke out right through Wales. Nobody was preaching. And then Jones took over and there was a lot of preaching going on. But initially it was just children praying. And revival broke out. In the Hebrides, the great Hebridean revival, it's recorded that two or three old ladies met together to pray for revival. And God answered the prayer. Time and time again, revival comes through prayer. And revival will come when the Christians of Northwood Hills and the area fall to their knees in humility, compassion, and prayer. Let me tell you about one of my heroes, a guy called Robert Murray McShane. And his name gives it away. He's a Scotsman, comes from Dundee. He was born in 1813. He became a Christian in 1834, saved at the age of 21. By the age of 23, he had qualified as a minister. He'd done a degree, even done an MA in 2 years, BA and ME, and became a minister in 2 years. And he died in 1843, aged 31. He had 8 years. He only had his 20s to serve God as a minister. He died when he was 31. And in that time, his church, St. Mary's in Dundee, was utterly transformed. The whole town was touched by McShane's ministry. And I remember reading more recently about a chap who visited St. Mary's Church in Dundee, and he said to the verger, "What was the secret of McShane's success? What did he do that made his church so fantastically successful?" And the verger said, "Come with me, sir." And he took him into McShane's study. And in the granite floor were two hollows. And he said, "Put your knees into these hollows and pray for hours." It's recorded that McShane would rise and be in his office at 5 o'clock in the morning. Because he believed, why should he not be about the Lord's business when the men were going to the shipyards in their hobnail boots at 5 a.m? Why should he not be about the Lord's business? And he would pray for 3 hours every morning. And he said once, "I am so busy that I need to pray more." And we might have said, "I'm so busy, I'll maybe just do an hour's prayer this morning. You know, only an hour." He said, "I'm so busy, I need to increase my prayer life." And then the verger said, "Now come with me to the pulpit." He took him into McShane's pulpit, said, "Stand there, put your hands either side of the pulpit." He said, "Lean forward and now weep." And he said, that was McShane's formula for success. He prayed and he wept. And you know what? I don't see too much of that in many of our churches. The prayer meeting is often the worst attended meeting in church. And not many people cry when they're preaching, including me. And the secret of McShane's success was no technique. It was prayer and compassion. Prayer and tears. So Jericho would be conquered, but not by self-will. That was McShane. And not by self-effort. The victory was going to be won without a blow being struck. Now I'm sure that the members of this church, I know the members of this church work hard. There are some people who have a very, very busy day job. And then at nights they're working for the church and they're exhausted. They are working hard. And so we should. We should work hard. But revival is God's work. And we don't get revival by earning it or deserving it or by working harder and harder. God doesn't bless us because we are hard workers. It doesn't happen that way. If you read the message of the angels to the churches in Revelations, in Revelation 2, verse 6, God says to the angel says to the people of Ephesus, "I know your works. You work really hard. You do great stuff. And like me, you challenge wicked men. You do all that. You're very hardworking. There's only one thing I want to pick up with you. You don't love me anymore. And if you don't return to your first love, I'll close the witness down here." And it happened. And so God isn't so much interested in how hard we work, he's interested in our hearts. He wants to know, do we have compassion, do we have love for him and compassion for the lost? And we can simply ask God to move and then trust that he will. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he wrote, "Give God no rest, give yourself no rest, keep on, bombard God, bombard heaven until the answers come. And then, until revival breaks out." So revival won't come just because we work hard. It's not a reward for effort. It's a gift from God whose ways are beyond finding out. So it's not by self-will. It's not by self-effort. And it's most certainly not for self-glory. It's not for self-glory. It looks a silly method, doesn't it? Joshua's out there in the field, and God says, "Here's how you're going to win the victory. Walk round it 6 times, and the 7th day walk it 7 times, and blow the trumpets, and the walls will fall down." There we go. Now I want you to imagine, this is not in the Bible, but I can't help imagining this. Joshua comes back from the fields. He's been walking in front of Jericho. He's spoken with Jesus. And he comes back and he says to the commanders, guys, I've just been speaking with God. And he's given me the way to win this victory. And you can just see them all going, wow, you spoke to God. Yeah, spoke to God. And he just said, here's the way to do it. Right, how do we do it? Tell us how you do it. Well, day one, we get everyone lined up. Priests go in front, Ark of the Covenant, soldiers around it. And we walk right around the city. Good, right, that's good, that's nice. So we're sort of spying the land out, if you like. Well, yeah, sort of. Okay, day two, what do we do? That's when we rush in with the swords. Day two, we sort of all get lined up. Priests at the front, soldiers, Ark of the Covenant, people at the back. And we all walk round the city. Right, belts and braces, okay? So we do it twice and we definitely pick up everything and it's good, good plan. Right, and then day three, boof, we're in. Nope, day three, we all line up, walk around the city and... What, do we stamp our feet hard or something? No, we just walk. Just walk again. Yep, walk again. Right, okay. Day four, a bit of fighting, Joshua? No, day four, we line... Walk round again. Yeah, walk round again. Day five, walk round again. Day six, yeah, walk round again. Joshua, this plan isn't sounding very good, is it? You know, when do we actually do the fighting bit? Day seven. Oh, day seven we fight. Well, not quite. Day seven we walk round seven times. Oh, seven times day seven, okay. And then we blow the trumpets. The walls fall down. What? Yeah, we blow the trumpets and the walls fall down. And yeah, we walk in. What? We just blow the trumpet and the walls are going to drop down. Yeah, that's the plan. That's what God said. Right. Joshua, was there any magic mushrooms out in that field when you were... Yeah. Does not sound like a great plan, does it? Nobody at the end of that is going to say, hey, did you see the plan I thought up? Walking around the city, boop, boop, and the walls fall down. It's not going to get the soldiers up for it, is it? And yet, that's exactly what happened. Walked around, blew the trumpets, walls fall down, victory before anything happened. Let's just say that revival broke out in this church. Do you know what would happen? The elders would be asked to write some kind of magazine article in Revival Monthly. Here's how we did it. And this is the strategy. We did this and we did that. We got this team here and whatever. And we did that. Then probably we'd be asked to speak at Spring Harvest and New Wine and any other Keswick, that type of thing. Go up and tell them how we did it. Copy us. You're fine. And then we might be asked to write a book, Fairfield Revival, and write the book. And might even be asked to record a CD, revival song, The Elders. Right? No, I'm just caught Tony's eye. He says, no. He's not prepared to do the revival CD. The rest is fine, but we're not doing the CD. It would happen, wouldn't it? If this church became a focus for revival and thousands of people were coming, we would have visitors from all over the world. Like the church in Toronto. People were flying all over the world to get the blessing and package it and bring it back again. That would happen. Murray McShane's church in Dundee experienced the most phenomenal revival. But guess what? He wasn't there when it happened. McShane was ill. He took ill, and it was an illness that led to his death eventually. And his church said to him, you need to get your strength back. Why don't you go on holiday, take a 3-month sabbatical, and you go away and get yourself well again. So McShane went off to the Holy Land for 3 months. And while he was there, he left the church in the hands of his young assistant, a guy called Mr. Burns. Let's see, Ian. Mr. Burns, the assistant. Not that Mr. Burns, right? And Mr. Burns began to preach. In 1 month, 800 people were saved. 800 people in 1 month. And McShane wasn't even there. McShane was on holiday. That's not fair. He's the guy that's been up at 5 praying for hours and hours, and he goes on holiday and revival breaks out. Doesn't seem fair.
He had laboured, he'd preached faithfully, he'd visited people, he'd agonised, he'd shed tears. And he goes on holiday, revival breaks out under the preaching of an unknown Mr. Burns. The ways of God are beyond knowing. And that's a great thing. God may send revival, but not so that any of us will get the glory. And let me say in closing, God isn't a Baptist, or a Brethren, or an Anglican, or a Catholic, or anything else. If you want to see God moving and pouring his blessing out on us, remember that God hasn't come to take sides. God has come to take over. And the question is, are you willing to let God take over?